listening to Drive Through HR. We are going to have a wonderful show today because we have a really smart person on, and I don't have to talk a whole lot, which is great. No, I'm just kidding. It's beautiful outside. The birds are chirping and all of that good stuff. Russell, how are you doing today, brother?
I'm doing okay, although here in Fairfax, Virginia, it is pouring rain outside.
Oh, well, this is one of those rare days where I can say Texas weather is better than Virginia weather because it's not. That's not normal. Normally, I don't get to say that. But we're not going to spend a whole lot of time talking about college football. But I did notice that your Trojans beat up on my poor little Wildcats over the weekend. But they look good. They look better. I think this game they look better than I've seen them all summer all season. So hopefully.
Well, hopefully. 50 guys to everyone else's 85, and so everyone expected it to be a rebuilding year. So
right.
Raymond at 9-3, and then back in the hunt next year.
I think you got the right coach. I believe in this guy. I don't know what it is yet, but the intangibles are there, and I maybe 3 years into it, I look for USC to be back and be a real force over there.
And you know the flip side of it is, at the moment, the PAC's on the rise, and the SEC, it's not on the decline, but it's certainly leveled out with everyone else.
I agree. Now, the SEC West is a gauntlet. I don't think anybody's going to go undefeated. I think the committee, God knows how they're going to make these decisions, but I think the committee is going to essentially get to the end of the year, and they've got a lot of one, possibly even two loss teams that are pretty good. And
I'm of the belief that it's going to be the conference champions of the four, and unless FSU runs the table, the ACC is going to be looking in from the outside.
Yeah, no, I think you're probably right. Now the Big 12, they don't have a conference championship, do they?
They don't, but they have the old Pac-10 model. So
got it.
Plays every other. So whoever emerges at the top,
head. That's essentially their person. Yeah, I think you're probably right. I don't think anybody in the SEC is going to go through unscathed. Like right now, there's a couple undefeated teams that we're going to get to the end of the season. Everybody's going to they'll have hung a loss on everybody. And I think you're probably right. This year is probably a year where if Notre Dame goes undefeated, that throws everything off. For everyone.
So, and this will be my last thought on college football. Rivalries have nothing to do with who's the better team on the field.
Oh, truth.
Right, true.
It's all
about emotion. USC will take it away from Notre Dame this year.
Oh, nice. Well, that's good. That's as it should be. That's that rich tradition between those two goals. All right, so do us a favor. Introduce yourself. Give the audience a little bit of who you are and what you do.
So my name's Russell Klosk. I am currently with Hewlett-Packard. At the moment, my current job is focused on long-term labor strategy and location strategy. We don't use these terms, but from a workforce planning perspective, I have been focused for the last 15 months on the labor side of the workforce planning equation. We are trying to get better, especially on the service side of the business, at how we forecast demand signal so that every time we sell something, it's not a mad scramble of who's available and let's staff this up so that we can do this work, but rather a plotted out, not just from a career ladder and career development perspective, but also from a what are we going to use full-time employees for, what are we going to use contractors, where are we going to use SOW labor, who's the right person to put in this role, not just because of their skill set, but because of the intangibles, the personality fit, for lack of a better term. And then, of course, IT outsourcing, which is our primary service business, has gotten very competitive and very global. And, we're not in a position, nor is any other American company, to go toe-to-toe with the Indians on a pure cost model. But at the same time, we have to compete against that in the market. And, if you're Pepsi Cola or Coca-Cola, it doesn't matter, random company X, you have this question to ask, am I going to get superior service for the extra $100 million over 5 years, or am I better off just going with the lowest cost? And how you differentiate yourself is based on the quality of the people you're putting in front of them.
Is it the old model of price, quality, and speed, and you can pick two? Go ahead.
I think that's part of it. I think it's evolved because the quality equation, the tools for how you categorize your supply side have gotten so sophisticated that it's almost how much money do you want to spend to know how much about your workforce, and then all these trends around big data and analytics. So there's a lot of applications to that, but one of them is all this information that companies just acquire about their workers almost by accident, and it ends up in a database. Well, you can start to use that to use rather sophisticated matching and say John is better than Jill, not because of any technical qualification, but because this client is type A go-getter and Jill's going to get eaten alive because she has a type B personality, right? And some of those things. So the quality equation has gotten more complicated. And then, you know, a lot of this, you know, the industry segmented. And so you end up with customers, and I'm going to use Procter & Gamble as an example. 20 years ago, when Procter & Gamble started outsourcing IT, they were looking for a single-point vendor. We'll sign a billion-dollar 10-year contract. It'll take us 18 months to go through the process and negotiate it. And whoever wins, they get to do our IT for us. And I'm using them as an example because that's not their model today. Procter & Gamble has IBM running their ERP systems, HP running their data centers, and Accenture running their analytics. Three companies that, while we all do the same thing and compete against each other, aren't notorious for getting along with each other, right? And yes, it's an incestuous industry, but that doesn't mean I want my competitor at the desk right next to me seeing how I do my job. And Procter & Gamble has gotten very good at managing the three against each other and creating a healthy sense of competition between them. And at the same time, instead of $1 billion contract, they've awarded $400 million contracts or $300 million contracts, whatever the numbers are. But they're saving a little money here and there, and at the same time, they've spread their risk out. And so the sales cycle is shortened as well. So we don't win $1 billion contracts with 18-month sales cycles now. Now we win $200 million contracts with 8-month sales cycles. And so we have to adjust to that in real time. Right, because our workers, we're not hiring them just for one contract. We're not a body shop. That's not what we're trying to do. But at the same time, the majority of them are deployed to support X client or X and Y clients for the next 2 years,
right,
until it's time for them to promote and move to the next thing. It's not the same as a Deloitte or a Pricewaterhouse where you're hopping contracts every 6 weeks and you're just going in to do one thing, right, because it's more of a steady state environment than a build environment.
Let me ask about, because you're going to have, with your Vista that you have, you're going to know more about internal mobility, how it actually works and how it, and juxtapose that with how it should work. So if you don't mind, give us your take on what you think internal mobility really looks like in corporate America.
So the old model, let's start with a base point. The old model, and it still exists in some points of corporate America, in some industries. So I live in Virginia, just outside of Washington, D.C. The old Mobil Oil headquarters is here from before they were acquired by ExxonMobil. And so that facility, which housed, until about 3 months ago, 15,000 people, Exxon is finally in the process of closing that down and consolidating to Houston. And in doing that, they are doing what mobility has always looked like. They're buying people's houses. They're paying reload packages. They're moving them. You know, similar job, same job, just different locations. There's a lot of that. And then there's the things that I've personally experienced in my past careers before coming to HP, where it's, we need you to go do this for the next 6 months, and it's a combination business need role and developmental opportunity. So we're going to stretch your skill set a little, but we need someone that can also do the things you can do and go live in China for the next 6 months, and you'll get some intercultural experience. And there's still some of that going on, not as much as there should be. That's probably economically driven. I think the trends in performance management, which is shifting currently from 100% being about compensation and putting a rating so I know what to give people for raises and bonuses, to more about that's only 10% of the equation and I'm really trying to drive behaviors, and it becomes more of a developmental plan. So that lends itself more to these developmental conversations from a mobility perspective. What's really going on in corporate America, and it's going both ways, it's not every job shifting overseas to low-cost countries, because manufacturing certainly starting to come back to the U.S. as well. But there are shifts to most cost-effective strategy. So that's not always where's the cheapest place I can do it. It's where's the place I can do it with the skill level I need for the best cost. And there's some of that going on, and the people that have to manage and run that have to be wherever they are. I don't think that the packages are as nice as they used to be. That's part of it. And then, you know, the one that's really changed, 3 years ago, there was this heavy push to teleworkers and mobile workforces, not in the sense of traditional mobility and I'm going to move someone, but you're going to work from home and you're only, you know, in the office when you need to be and you're only a client site when you need to be, and let's reduce our real estate footprint. And, you know, Yahoo actually started pulling people back in. There's a synergy that's created in an office, obviously, you know, it's a balance between the two. But corporate America has done what corporate America always does. It's swung to one extreme, and now it's swinging back to the other extreme. And, you know, any number of companies, and HP is included in that list, have gone to the everyone needs to be on site again that lives within X distance of an office. And that creates challenges from recruiting because you still want to get the best people, and they may not be in the right places for you geographically, which begs the mobility question. Do I move them? Do I leave them and let them do the mobile work, right?
Let me ask, Russell, let me get your take on training. It's my perception that we don't invest enough in training, and there's probably a lot of legitimate reasons for why I feel that way and why I perceive that we, you know, that the transferability of okay, you train somebody and then they can leave, et cetera, and so on. My perception is it seems like we should train people more to be more competent in their jobs. Now, first of all, I could be wrong at that. You're working the desk, so you actually see what gets done. What's your bit? What's your take on training in America?
So if you ask, and I'm not a corporate training officer, obviously,
right,
but if
right.
you ask a corporate training officer at a Fortune 500 company, they're going to come back with an 8 or 9 figure budget that they're spending in training every year. And I'm absolutely certain that's true. And let's take the compliance training out, the sexual harassment
right.
that you have to do because it's about ethics and, you know, all those things.
Right.
The rest of it, you know, there was this massive shift because it's very expensive to do classroom-based training to online learning. That's not necessarily a bad thing, but it negates the fact that not everyone learns the same way. And some people need to learn in a classroom, and some people learn better in simulations, and some people are just fine with a CBT, and you should be offering a spread of those options to your employees, even if some of it's more costly. And so, you know, that trend against the costly and the let's travel people and put them in these classroom-based trainings to learn X software or Y competency or develop leadership skills, that seems to have trailed off. It picks up again at about the director or senior director level. But that's not where your heavy churn is in your workforce. And what you really need to keep and make better is the people that are doing the heavy lift, which is your professional staff, your senior managers, the people that the client interacts with on a day-to-day basis. Because if your client is interacting with a senior vice president on a day-to-day basis, either they're your largest client, which is fine, or something's going really wrong and someone's putting themselves in there to do it. So I think some of that has occurred, and that lends itself to the generational workforce challenge as well. And then careers have swung too far to the self-directed. So it's great that you have this wonderful learning library. And then the discussion on what you should take is between me and my manager, and let's come up with some kind of IDP. And what goes in there is what I'm able to dig out of the system and say, I'd like to do this in the next year. As opposed to some kind of old school, you know, HR actively involved in directing people up a career ladder. Now, I'm not suggesting we should go back to the other extreme, but there's a happy medium between them. And just like I said with the mobility, we swung far too far to one side, and we need to swing back the other way. We've been in a recession and then an, in essence, flat market, and you'll pick your country, but for the last 6 years, it's hard to do these things when unless you're Google, it's hard to do these things until you start to see an upside in your business environment, because, well, it might make all the sense in the world logically and economically and historically to double down your bets and double your training budgets in the slow times. The Wall Street expectations don't work that way. And so it's that constant flux and battle. And so I think there's a lot of change going on there. But I agree with your assessment. We should be making people absolutely as good as possible as we can at their jobs. And if we're making them better and challenging them every day and paying them fairly and giving them opportunities for growth, the 10% that are going to leave, it happens. right? A little turnover is not a bad thing. A lot of turnovers is. And so some's healthy and just accept a certain amount are going to walk out the door.
Right.
Now, I'll caveat that and say, back in the day, I grew up at what was Coopers & Lybrand Consulting, and my MBA is a gift from Coopers & Lybrand Consulting. I didn't pay a dime for it.
Right.
And, you know, they got 3 years more from me as a result of that. I never even looked. Everyone in my class, when I graduated, went into investment banking with the exception of myself and one other individual who went to McKinsey. And I had those options. I was getting the same nibbles everyone else was, but never even looked. I said, I have a good job. They're paying for my MBA. They get 3 years of my time.
That's the right thing to do. Let me ask you, because you brought up turnover, if you could only measure one thing, I know you can measure more than that, but if you could only measure one thing, what would be the one thing that you would love to keep your finger on the pulse of the organization? What would that be?
Yeah, so it's tricky because there is no one golden BB.
That's right.
Right, but I would say I would measure customer delight, however you measure that, because if the customers are happy, the employees that are providing services to them are probably happy. Right, and then you can validate that with ancillary measures. So I can validate that by saying my turnover is low, or my employee voice in the workforce surveys come back positive, and employee engagement is X. But really, what's driving it? So if the customer is happy, all those other things have to be in line. Right? Do we have good products? Are people happy? Are the people showing that to the customers? Are they challenged? It almost leads to that. So that's not the golden BB, but it's as good a measure as anything
that
you can trace back. Right?
Yeah, healthcare does a really good job of that because they look at patient satisfaction. And they kind of bubble that up and say, you know what, we're going to keep our own patient satisfaction. Everything falls there at one point or another.
Yeah, well, and there's patient satisfaction, even if we take that back into the corporate structure. So this concept of employee wellness,
mm-hmm.
which, let's be real, most companies do it because their insurance companies give them a break
right.
on their rates if they do it. But at the same time, you should be able to look at your data and say, you know, the actuarial tables say that X number of our employees are going to get cancer this year, and less than that got it here, right? And is that a statistical anomaly, or is it because we're paying extra money for preventative and buying them gym memberships and teaching them how to eat healthy and, you know?
Right.
And I bet, you know, it's not just a cluster, and that there, you know, I know there's statistical data that says the more you spend there, that the healthier your workforce is, and therefore the more productive they are.
So now let's pivot and talk about talent management. What's your favorite part of talent management, and what do you despise, or what is your least favorite aspect of talent management?
So my least favorite is the easy one because it's not where my expertise is. So in talent management is an awful big brush, and and certainly part of your talent strategy involves your compensation and benefit strategy. And so me as a talent, you know, I think of workforce planning as strategy and talent management as execution, and devil's in the details. But at the transactional level, how you make compensation decisions, what you're going to pay someone, what your annual raises are going to be, where that faces off against your competitors, that's a unique skill set, right? That's a specialization within the profession that I never want to know how to do. It's by far my least favorite, but that doesn't mean it's not necessary. Because I need to look at that just to make labor location strategy decisions. And I need to know that if my turnover starts to spike, that's one of the levers I can push on if I choose to do something about it. And one of the, you know, we've all seen exit interview surveys, and we know that compensation isn't why people leave. But if you get far enough out of the flux, yeah, they'll go. Right.
Right.
And so, you know, talent always follows the money. And so, you know, we've had discussions. We have legacy data centers. In places that are not necessarily great tech markets. That's not to say there isn't great tech talent there, but if the average programmer, I'm just making a random one up, but if the average programmer analyst in Detroit makes $60,000 a year and the average programmer analyst in Silicon Valley makes $140,000 a year, the question is begged to why, and the reality is it's not because it costs a lot more to live in the Silicon Valley than it is Detroit. It's because the skill set of that gentleman or lady is worth $140,000 a year, and that's market-driven.
That's right.
Right. And if you're willing to trade that and say, no, we want the low-cost people and we're going to build this huge data center in Detroit, you'll get the best programmers that are in Detroit. You may get the next Bill Gates walking in the door. You know, that's certainly possible. but you're also going to get a lot of $60,000 talent.
That's right.
That hasn't figured out what they need to do to become the 140.
Right.
So that's my least favorite part of it. It's an absolutely necessary part. It's just not where my expertise has been as a process and strategy guy. And so I know enough about how to do it to be dangerous and don't know how to get into the weeds and actually take someone's survey data and turn that into a comp band and all the rest of it. On my favorite side, it's always been about this concept of organizational effectiveness, because organizational effectiveness touches on those big, broad talent management brushes. So how many leaders do I need, when and where? And then, you know, there's my leadership planning and my succession planning. And, you know, how am I going to deploy people on projects, or who am I going to put in charge of what? And that starts to get into my day-to-day employee development and my day-to-day workforce management. And the business decisions about what work is in our sweet spot and we're going to keep it in-house, and what work isn't and we're going to outsource it. And so those elements of talent management, those are the ones I've always enjoyed. And then they tag, of course, directly to sourcing strategy. And by that, that's not just, you know, recruiting. That's overall sourcing strategy.
Right.
How am I going to meet my business needs? And then the subsets of that start to break down to where am I going to recruit, how am I going to recruit. And, of course, that piece of talent management that is talent acquisition has gone through a seismic shift change in the last 5 or 6 years as social media has truly grabbed on and become the main source, just as it did when we went from faxing resumes to job boards.
Right.
And, you know, as a guy that started my career 23 years ago as a recruiter, I wouldn't know how to do it today. I can design you a nice process how to do recruiting, but the actual, you know, step in the process where it's go source candidates, you know, that step has changed so much.
Yeah, we don't want to go back and live those nightmares. Let me ask you, I got two questions. One is about implementations, the other is about external data. So on implementations, you've been a party to a lot of implementations. You've run them, you've been on the receiving end of implementations, etc. Tell the audience what you think the typical pitfalls, like where are the bodies buried typically in implementations?
So you measure the success of the implementation by rollout and usability, right? So HP is a Workday shop. We went live last April. So if that's our global HRIS system, are all of our employees using it for annual reviews, for performance reviews? Are all of the core HR elements up and running and everyone's been trained and all the people that need to access the system? And that's fine and that's important, but the pitfall is, are they using it or are they just doing what they have to, right? And we're in this world of big data and analytics, and I know those are buzzwords, but let's talk about them for just a second. The core reason you employ a technology is to solve a business problem. And so the question that people forget to ask, because they get so hung up in let's get it rolled out and implemented and the software life cycle and, you know, all the rest of it, that they forget, we were trying to solve a business problem. Did we actually do that? And what was that business problem? Are we bleeding money? Are we just, our data's not in one gold source? Whatever that business problem was, we're trying to improve margin. We're trying to increase profit. Whatever that was, the gut check after it's deployed is, does it solve it? And if it doesn't, why not? What should we be doing differently? And that leads back to, and this is where I was going with the analytics comment, if I have gold source data, I should be able to pull that out and tell stories with it. But lies, damn lies, and statistics, the data will tell you anything you want it to if you're going looking for a preconceived, condition. And so what you want to do is say, what story is it actually telling me? Not what story do they want to hear, what's it actually telling me? And the best example I can use is, and all of this is in the public record in our annual report, so I'm not going to say anything that I can't, but HP's historic turnover rate over 75 years globally is 8.2%, which, that's a wonderful statistic that means nothing, right? But what happens as a result of that is we've put all our core data in one spot, so now we can do modeling and reporting, and both, you know, backward-looking real-time reporting and forward-looking predictive analysis, and say, where's the trend going? And we come up with a report that says we have 22% turnover in Brazil. And so what happens? That pops up on some C-level executive's dashboard, and they go, wait a second, 22 versus 8.2, big red flag, because the software did what it was supposed to and raised the red flag. workforce planners, HR people, line managers, what's going on? Fix it, right? We can't have 22% turnover. It doesn't take you the next step and say, but the turnover in the high-tech industry in Brazil at the moment is 42%, or half the national average, right?
That gets me to a pet peeve I have. At some point, somebody's got to make sense of the data. And we all know, if we flash forward 20 years, that internally finance and HR and a bunch of really capable data-oriented people will make sense of the data. But up until that point, vendors are going to have to come to the table with some type of insights as a service. Here's what the data is telling us. It's not enough to just have a dashboard. Dashboard, great, fantastic, red, yellow, green. That doesn't tell me, to your point, all the context. Let me ask, because I know people are going to be curious about this. External data sources as it relates to the things that you look at. So, like, you've been looking internally at HP and all the different things that you should be connecting, et cetera. Are you at the point now, or do you think that you will be at the point where you start looking at external data sources and bringing those, piping those in, and in such a way to where you look at data from outside the four walls? Go ahead.
So the short answer is yes. The more complicated answer is depends where, right, and depends what. So, you know, one of the challenges that HP and every other large company has is we pull all this external data in, and we don't always focus it at HR. So I have all this wonderful external market data of which markets are going to grow in the next 3 years and which are going to shrink and which are just going to be flat, that we pull in for marketing and sales and forecasting purposes. And it never comes into the HR department unless someone in HR is smart enough to ask. Let me see that too. But good workforce planners are doing scenario planning, best case, worst case, most likely case, and not for the whole company. They're doing it in specific little billets in Brazil in services, right? Because it's a moving target. And so the software can enable that, but it can't give you the external data feed. And the reason it can't is some markets have – there is no one source. There is no one place I can go and go, give me external labor market data for IT services for the world, for the 205 countries that HP does business in, right? That data doesn't exist. It exists in depth in Western Europe, and it exists in depth in the U.S., and, you know, we all know what the core data centers are in places like Saratoga, where you can get all this, like, massive amount of information. But peeling the onion back a couple of layers, it's going to be different in each country, and it's going to be different in each market. And, you know, so what we do in our hardware side versus our services side is different data I'm after for the labor market. And so you have to constantly find people that can say, what's out there? And is it of use to us? And is it enough of use to us that we're going to pull it in some way? Almost all of the software products on the market now that do workforce planning specifically and workforce management specifically have the ability to take those feeds and automate them and put it all in the same place so you can manipulate, but which is great, but you have to be able to do that. And so, yeah, I agree. The software vendors should be coming with, here's leading practice and baseline in your industry, external things that are available to you, and where you can get them, and here's the ones we have partnerships with and can pull in easily for you, and here's the others that you'd have to do on your own, and all of them. And then there's certain markets where it just doesn't exist, right?
Right.
If you're looking at Peru, you're probably struggling a little to find it.
Yeah, you can get data in Lima. Outside of Lima, you're dead. There's nothing there. Yeah. It's just a big ghost.
And that might not be the best example, but so, you know, sub-Saharan Africa, which is certainly a growth market, right? It's an almost untapped.
Nice.
It's an almost untapped growth market, but there's no market data, and even if someone's studying it, it'll be 10 years before it'll be useful.
Right. All right, listen, we blew through 30 minutes. I want to make sure that the at RussMK is your perfect Twitter handle. DM must be a middle name, I'm assuming, Matthew?
Yes, Martin.
Martin, very nice, family name. So, Russell, always wonderful to talk with you. I'm looking forward to kind of the next chapter. And obviously, being on Facebook, we make fun of each other quite a lot, and I enjoy that as well. So thanks for being on the show, by the way. Thanks for being on the show. And ladies and gentlemen, we're out of time. Everyone have a wonderful afternoon, and thanks again for listening to Drive Through HR. Thanks, Russell. Bye.